Hello, everybody, and welcome to Ultimate Despair Reprise, a Danganronpa recap podcast going through the entire Danganronpa franchise, one murder at a time. I am, of course, your ultimate host, Kyrie.
I'm the ultimate podcaster, Jennifer.
Yeah.
Every time.
Good follow-up, everyone.
I'm Jackie. You probably haven't heard my voice in a hot minute. I am I'm just some asshole.
Some asshole who has a name.
Yeah, I know. I said my and once again, Kiri, I said my name, you just weren't listening. I feel like Kiri's the ultimate distracted student. I feel like that's your new ultimate. I guess I'm Monokuma now, and I'm the one who assigns the ultimates.
Right.
Anyway,
what's my name?
Time to introduce the ultimate sleepy bench. What's up, Inez?
I'm Ines.
Yeah, she's Ines. So,
and today we are covering the investigation and trial of Chapter 3 of Danganronpa 1, Trigger Happy Havoc. And today we're introducing a little bit of a format change. We're going to try something a little new, a little less loosey-goosey, and we're going to give you a quick summation of some of the events that occurred in this case. So, Jackie, if you could give us a quick summation of what happened.
Yeah, so I'm going to give a quick rundown. I broke it up into four parts, so it's a little easier to digest. So we got the pre-trial. So, unlike other trials before us, we start off with a conspicuous lack of info. But that doesn't stop everybody from jumping to Yasuhiro as the culprit. We end up doing a quick runabout, in which we pick up our clues, you know, one of the most notable of which are a wet mallet, Hifumi's cleaned glasses, the bloodstains in the room where the deaths took place, and there was a fridge in the nurse's room that was, stocked with blood packets, so that they were able to manipulate the scene. Another note was that this started off as a little bit of a locked room puzzle. The storage room door, it locks from the inside. But the only people in there, presumably, were the two corpses. So that led us to a little bit of a runaround as well. We end up looking for the person in the Robo Justice suit, and he turns up. It's Yasuhiro. Turns out it's extremely a pain in the ass to wear. Aoi Asahina tries it on, and she can't fucking move at all in it. Can't bend down, can't see her feet. That's important info for later. And we find the blueprints for the suit in Yasuhiro's room. And there's a clasp on the back that's also relevant. So we also find some notes in people's hands. Turns out Hiro, Taka, and Hifumi were each baited into a room. They were manipulated by the killer, as it turns out, via these notes. And at some point during the trial, Hifumi straight up says, "Yasuhiro killed me," which throws a little bit of a wrench into the works, among other things. Dude will not stay down. Extremely wordy for a dead man. So at this point, we are after the investigation into the trial. Again, everybody's really gung-ho about it being Hiro, especially, you know, given the stakes. The handwriting of the blueprints, as it turns out, does not match Yasuhiro's own handwriting. But, you know, it asks you again, like, okay, who was in the suit then? And it was definitely, you know, Yasuhiro was the only one who wore that suit. It was sized for him specifically. The dolly and tarp were used to move Taka, and it turns out his murder was actually a lot more straightforward. He was simply killed and then moved. And Celestia, and at this point, when you bring up the dolly and the tarp, Celestia goes on the offense here. I think this was a good change of pace from the usual use of the bullet time battle, but we'll go into that a little bit more. So that does lead into the first bullet time, into the bullet time battle in of this sequence, which is the main set piece. So it is confirmed after the sequence that Hiro could not have killed and moved Taka because you can't bend at the waist as Robo Justice, and you would need to either bend at the waist or kick the dolly as, you know, to get it from point A to point B. And the hammer numbers were used as a decoy. They were not killed in the order that the hammers implied. Taka's watch was broken at 6 a.m., so he was killed at about that time. And his corpse discovered chime was used to cover up Hifumi being alive. The chime sounds again with both bodies are discovered, though, and that blows Hifumi's cover. Kind of retroactively. And he's confirmed that he was alive when you found him the second. He was confirmed to be alive at some point due to the fact that he cleaned his glasses between being in the nurse's office and being in the storage room. So he was when we killed Taka. And that gets established, and it gets established that there was a second killer involved, and you are asked to finger the killer, and or maybe let's frame that in a little less.
Yeah, let's try. Let's.
You were
let's
asked
try that
to
again.
Pick who you were asked to pick who you believe to be the killer, and the correct person to select is Celeste, and she is absolutely not thrilled with this accusation. She drops a fucking bomb ass line that my name is Celestia Ludenberg, goddammit, and that's the only truth there is. Which, stone fucking cold. I have been a big fan of her character from the get-go. I'm extremely a fucking fan of her character during this trial. So, very specifically, we're going down, like, you know, the killer man is killer man bit. We do the little comic creation. So the killer persuaded Hifumi to be an accomplice. Celeste specifically fed him a shitty H-Dugin plot to get him going against Taka. A little bit creepy, but Hifumi's a creep, so it does fit. They got Hiro to meet in the rec room at 1 a.m. with them, and then they knocked him out and shoved him in the suit. They staged the attack picks first, and they shoved Hiro into a locker like a big fucking Melvin. and they called Taka to the equipment room, murked his ass with Hammer 4. Celeste faked her assault with Hammer 1. Hifumi faked his assault with Hammer 2, and then his own death with Hammer 3. And then he swaddled Taka up in the tarp and yeeted on out of there. To get his ass to the storage room, and then the killer murdered Hifumi for real. And that killer's name, Albert Einstein. Oh, I mean, Yasuhiro Taiko.
Killer Man.
Celestia. Killer Man. And we've established that Killer Man is Killer Man. It was the gray naked guy all along. And we elect Celestia as president.
Guy.
Oh, it's always the gray naked guy. That fucking. I don't know why we haven't kicked him out of the school yet. He's killed all of our friends so far. So Celeste gets elected president. Everybody Pokemon Go goes to the polls, finally. and she's pretty calm about the whole thing, and Hifumi said fuck in the flashback, and that's why he died. And her motive, she states that her motive was she wants to live in a European castle with 1,000 vampire combat butlers, which is a big mood.
I mean, really, can anyone blame her? I don't
honestly,
think
honestly, that's,
can.
Yeah. Honestly, yeah, you know what? She should walk. Like, honestly, give your girl justice. And then leaving on the note of, on a melancholy note of perhaps we'll meet again in another life, the burning of the Versailles Witch begins. And that's our summary. I think I did a pretty good job for the first series summary.
So, right at the top, so we got two dead bodies. So, Hifumi, like, I guess the first thing that kind of comes to mind is that Hifumi is a terrible hamster man that really just won't stay down. Like,
I find think that, yeah. Hifumi is fucking unkillable.
like,
the Trash Void tried to claim him and could not, and I think that says more about him than anything else. Hifumi is an unkillable trash man.
Yeah, it does the thing where, I think it's one of those things that you can do this line exactly once, which is fictional character goes, this isn't like a movie or a TV show, this is real life, and then something miraculous happens. You could do that exactly once, and even one time is kind of cheesy, silly, but Asahina, you know, drips some tears over Hifumi, not sure why. I mean,
that CG is hilarious.
Well, you're still seeing a dead body of a classmate. That's, even if he's a shitlord, being confronted with someone's corpse is kind of a thing.
You're I mean, right. I get it in within the text, like why that is, why it is what it is. As an outsider looking in, though, who doesn't have the investment into the series that you do, Fuck, that CG is some goof-ass bullshit. Oh my god.
I was scream laughing when I saw that CG.
Yeah, I kind of cackled a little. I did a little bit of a cackle there. That was pretty wild.
It's so ridiculous because, like, I think most of the CGs, especially in this chapter, it's like, I don't know if they were hand-drawn. It looks like they were, like, the characters were, like, they had 3D models at some point. They were posed and then, like, a filter applied. It's so weird how, like, all the characters have this, like, stiff, like, look doll-ass look. Yeah.
So, maybe the doll-like look is kind of intentional.
Yeah. I think the prospect of holding onto Hifumi's huge fucking head and being like, oh no, Hifumi, why did you go? And then just fucking crying big globby tears onto his face, and then he wakes up and he's like, Yasuhiro killed me! Ah! And then he dies again.
Yeah.
It's just some fucking wild shit out of context. Especially because the series is like, Makoto immediately beforehand is like, oh, this isn't a movie. He's not gonna come back up. What's he gonna do? Come back up from the dead? And then Hifumi immediately comes back up from the dead.
Right. Yeah, in terms of the visual stuff, I feel like this particular artist, he kind of hits his stride later on in the series a bit, so...
Yeah.
For the first one, you definitely see a bit more hesitancy. Then the character designs get increasingly out there for 2 and 3 and V3, and as a result, the art gets more intense.
It gets much stronger.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a thing when I look at the character designs for the later games. Hifumi's design is pretty much pure comic. Like, you can't really do anything with Hifumi. Like, you can't do pathos with Hifumi. You can't do anything really dramatic or, like, tragic with him because he's a big, creepy hamster man who jerks off all the time. He's a fucking creepy dude.
Yeah.
Constantly fucking beating his meat.
Sorry, go ahead.
And after that, I guess the other comic characters that I remember there's that, like, Ultimate Tennis Pro in V3 and some other designs I've seen. I think maybe the chef in V2. But, like, even those designs, they're outlandish, but they're not, like, they're not at that level of caricature where you can be, like, where you can't, where, like, so, like, you can feasibly take them seriously.
Totally.
So this scene kind of falls flat. But that said, I do like, one of the things I noticed he said is like, before I met you, I met you. And first of all, I actually think that line's pretty cool. It's definitely weird to see it uttered by Hifumi, especially because he's a fucking weirdo. But like, I definitely like that it's like this idea that he has. That also, I've never been wrong because I called this out already. I said that, yes, everybody has already spent a year at Hope's Peak. They all knew each other before this. And then they got tranked and then their memories were erased. And it turns out, and I think what we just saw was Hifumi remembering on the brink of death, like all the things that had been erased from his mind. So I think that's a cool plot point. Video games.
Yeah, they give him the one, like one of the, like, reveals of the... There's a couple reveals in this chapter, actually, that rather like...
Yeah, there's a reveal, like, later on. You go into, like, a secret room or some shit.
But moving on, so we find... So after Hifumi's second dramatic death, we get the second body announcement video pre-recording played. And everybody's kind of looking for... they're trying to figure out, like, where people are, and I think it's around this point in which someone brings up, it's like, oh shit, like, 2 people are dead, are we going to have another victim? And then Monokuma, who's kind of quiet this chapter, just pops up and says, no, the killer can only kill 2 people. If they kill a third, I kill him.
Monokuma was quiet this I thought he was fucking on my shoulder. I could swear, last time we convened to talk Danganronpa, like, the daily life sequence was Monokuma extremely, like, crawling up my ass about literally everything. I think Inez pointed it out.
Well, you see, during that point, they kind of ran out his appearances budget. Wait, my mic cut out. Let me get that again.
Yeah, your mic cut out.
Yeah,
can you repeat that line real quick for us?
Well, you see, during the daily life section, he appeared so many times that they actually ran out his appearance budget. They legally couldn't book him any more times.
They couldn't book any more cameo appearances. They ran out of money for that scene.
Yeah.
Yeah, every time Monokuma shows up in a scene, it costs Spike Chunsoft $10,000.
Yeah, it's like firing the heavy from TF2's gun.
Yeah.
Costs the GDP of a small country.
Mm-hmm. It costs $10 million for Monokuma to show up. For Cartoon Bear to show up in 45 seconds.
Jet, you looked like you had something to say.
No, I was just smiling.
Well, alright. But yeah, Cartoon Bear. But I felt like he only really popped up for like a rules explanation, and it was kind of after that where Byakuya initially thinks like, this case is in the bag now. It's clearly Yasuhiro. We gotta go find this dipshit. And then Makoto is the one who's like, no, wait a minute, let's actually think about this for, like, longer than 20 seconds.
Yeah, fuck Byakuya. I'm really waiting for him to get his comeuppance. I feel like this sequence was very much, Byakuya getting caught up to, I guess, essentially by Makoto, and he very much does not like that. But also I feel like that's kind of overdue. Like, part of why I think Byakuya and Celeste should have just been rolled into the same character is because, like, Byakuya gets really fucking good. Byakuya is, like, really obnoxious at this point. And if they don't do something with his character quick, I'm gonna lose my shit.
Yeah, like, at this point, it kind of feels like Byakuya is mostly being used to insult Makoto and also drop, like, breadcrumbs.
Yeah, he's 50% drip feeding you information that you kind of already know, and the other half of it is like, oh, Makoto, you're so fucking stupid, fuck you, you piece of shit idiot. Yeah. And it's like,
sorry, go ahead.
Part of it, you know, and it's like, I hope that they do something with him, but at the same time, I feel like they've kind of been dragging their feet with it.
Go ahead.
I think this definitely seems like the sort of thing that later games improve on, maybe with their kind of semi-antagonistic characters. But I was expecting that, I was like, kind of expecting his arc to be over with already. Like,
right.
I was kind of expecting him to have come around and been like, okay, you know what, this attitude that I had hasn't gotten me anywhere by, like, the end of the last chapter. And to actually be, like, focused on survival instead of, haha, dumb game, nobody dies. Or, like, haha, dumb game, other people die but not me. When, like, we've lost half of our students already.
Right. Jen, you were saying?
Yeah, so the thing about antagonistic characters within the series, they all have different themes within them. And they all have different motivations and what drives them. A lot of what's going on with Byakuya specifically is, he has such an ego from his position that even when he's been proven wrong again and again, he's still quietly sort of relying on Makoto to do the legwork so he can swoop in and save the day, because he still sees himself as someone who's been born to take charge. He's been born to take charge of the
he's a scion of, like, a corporate conglomerate.
Saibatsu.
Yeah. My big concern, though, about him, though, is that the game has kind of failed to endear me to him as an antagonist. So I don't, like, so, like, when he's, like, a dick to Makoto, it doesn't feel, it's not like, oh, he's a dick to Makoto, he's just that guy you love, it doesn't feel like he's doing that, he doesn't feel vulnerable. He feels like he's just uniformly acting a certain way, and it just, it's the way he acts is just kind of unpleasant to engage with.
Right.
And it's, it might just be personal taste.
Yeah, I think definitely, I can already say that next chapter is a little, has a little bit of a focus on, like, they talk, like, let's just say that Byakuya does get confronted in the next chapter. Like, we're going to see some growth with, like, these characters.
Yeah.
Also.
Go ahead, sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, also, Byakuya's arc is slightly more towards realism than the other antagonists within the series, so there is this sense that he takes a little bit of, he takes a long time to learn, and it takes a long time to improve. And it's not fun and theatric and charismatic like it is for some of the other antagonists, but there is this sense of grounded, this guy is an asshole and we're stuck with him, and we have to recognize that, well, we're gonna keep trying to show him that what he's doing is wrong, and it may take or it may not.
Yeah, and that's a good way I think my main concern again with him is that the game tends to frame him as right about things, and not just an insecure asshole. But at the same time, you know, of course, if he's going to get called out next chapter, we'll see how that develops, and I'm kind of,
yeah,
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Now we've spent enough time hollering about Byakuya. Let's check out what we have next in the notes. In mine specifically, I put in that I really like how Genocide or Sho is kind of this Hannibal Lecter figure, where it's like she's a serial killer that kind of, I guess in a very vague sense of the term, helps you find who really did it.
She's still hilarious. She's still incredible,
yeah, she's,
every time she,
yeah,
shows,
she's
up,
a good time.
And as I know, you have a particular affection for Genocide or Sho.
Yeah, I really like her. I really enjoy her character. Like, I really like some of the stuff that she does in this chapter specifically. Like she kind of points out a little bit, like, oh, if I was doing the murder, I would have done this. And kinda points out that, like, yeah, I'm the experienced serial killer here, but that doesn't mean I don't have standards.
Yeah, like,
there's a reason why I've never been caught.
She's just great. During the trial, she has this, like, hilarious line where, we're just in general, like, you know how in the trial you can see the camera swooping around? Things like that? It has a tendency where, when the camera is swooping, it leaves the characters in their last used sprite, and most of the time for Genocide or Sho, it's her just yucking it up. So it's really funny to see this dramatic, like, camera swoop. It pass her, and she's just cackling and having a good time. Like, during the trial, at one point, she plugs a website, I think called, like, what? Murder.com?
It's like murdertools.com/hammertime.
Yeah, I actually looked up that website. It does not, unfortunately, go to a Danganronpa-related thing. It goes to some guy's, like, page for, like, skate shop stuff. It was very bizarre.
Okay, Kari, I'm kind of worried that you might be on a watch list now.
Yeah, you definitely, they're definitely looking,
what?
They're definitely looking
you up. You looked up murder tools.
Code.
Yeah, very specifically, though, she does that in response to the, like, oh, where'd they get the justice hammers? And that's, I kind of fucking love that she's just, she's a big asshole because, She I feel like, is a big asshole in a very fun way that, like,
yeah, she's like, say my name and I'll appear. And she just sort of does, and it's like,
yeah, she's this goofy, like, she's fucking Wile E. Coyote.
Except successful.
Oh, yeah, I'm very much expecting her to, like, show up in the next chapter with a big stick of dynamite that's, like, shaped like a cigar. And she just lights it, and it blows up in her face, and just leaves it, like, leaves just, like, a smoke cloud. And it's like, wow, that's some strong stuff!
There's also a really good line in there about how, at this point, she mentions that if everyone keeps, like, immediately suspecting her, she's going to be, like, the exact phrasing that she uses is special guest suspect.
Yeah, it rules.
It's great. She is a beacon of light and just a really fun time to have around. And we have her around when we discover Yasuhiro in the fucking closet like a chump. Like the first thing we get him out of the closet.
Very specifically, it is a locker. I feel like that needs to be pointed out. He got shoved into a locker, in my own words, like a big fucking Melvin.
Yeah, he's shoved in a locker in the giant robot suit, and the first thing he says is like, "Man, I've had a rough day," or something to that effect.
She's like, he kind of just fucking shows up with no fanfare. I'm pretty sure he's not even aware that people actually died. He's just like, "Wow, I just flew in from Detroit, and boy, are my arms tired."
The edibles like wore off right around the time. Yeah, they wore off right around the time they got him out of the locker.
Yeah, they pull him out of the locker, and he was hotboxing the locker. He was hotboxing the Robo Justice suit.
And the locker? Holy shit.
Yeah, he was that is double hot advanced. Box. It's a double boiler method. Have you ever melted chocolate before, Inez? It's a double boiler method.
I also like how right away Hifumi's / Celeste's plan is falling apart because they all realize as a group that Hagakure can't get out of the suit he was stuffed into or supposedly put on his own. So they're like, huh, that's weird.
I think as a note, Hifumi designed the suit, so Celestia's more like, wow, I picked the stupidest possible people to work with. I'd be better off with Hagakure.
I really picked the one guy who would fit. It's like, oh, it's for cosplay, and you need a cosplay partner. It's like, Fumi, I swear to God, we're just trying to murder somebody.
Listen, I'm just trying to do a murder. I don't need to fuck around. I need to fuck around with a full cosplay.
It's a fully functional robot. Yes, I'm aware it's a fully functional robot.
I really like to imagine.
And the dick comes out.
I really like to imagine the alternate universe where Celeste asked like Genocide or Show to help her out, and Genocide or Show just like
cackles and leaves,
just like foils her at every turn.
She ruins her murder plot. Like, but nobody here is hot. I can't do it. motherfuckers are too hideous to murder.
Except Byakuya. I will murder
him.
No,
especially Byakuya. Fuck Byakuya. Delete him from the game. Delete him from the game. Genocider Show is just warning for him as a joke.
Delete Byakuya.jpg.
Remove Byakuya.
Who do we replace him with? Like a JPEG of like a piece of cake?
Toko again.
Just replace him with another Celeste. Give me two Celestes. Give me two Celestes.
Cool Butler Celeste.
Honestly, I joke about it, but if they did roll Byakuya into Celeste, I feel like I'd lose my shit. Like they could make Celeste like a central antagonist. If that was the case. And wow, she was a fucking good antagonist. Can we talk about that for a little bit?
Let's talk about Celestia Ludenberg, goddammit. That's the only truth there is.
That's the only fucking truth there is.
She's so fucking good in this chapter.
Yeah, she is.
Yeah. For me,
what's your opinion? Oh, sorry.
No, it's all good. I was just gonna say that, like, Celeste is a really fun character like, I love the fact that her whole breakdown is that basically when you finally point out that she was the mastermind behind this little particular plot, and basically saying, like, yeah, you fucking idiots, I've been lying about that cooperation stuff. I've wanted to get out of here since day one. I've wanted to get out of here harder than anybody else here. And, like, that sort of, like, complete facade has worn away, and she just doesn't give a shit. And she switches to, go ahead.
I'm getting you off here, but I do kind of like how, at the end, there's a very minor, but nonetheless, you can't really dismiss it, implication that her entire facade wasn't 100%. Like, that she was actually, that she did actually want to work with everybody and get out of there, and that she did, you know, she did honestly like the people here, and she did want to, but at some point she just decided that it was, you know, she hated it so much in the school, that she was willing to do anything for
them. Yeah, if she didn't like them, that she wouldn't have handed Kyoko, or Kiryuri the locker key.
Yeah.
To where they were keeping Alter, and
she wouldn't have been so hush hush about Alter Ego.
Yeah, she wouldn't say, "Oh, we have like she." Her the line she says is, "I don't see much hope in this, but if you do, then like go for it." Basically, like
yeah, essentially that's her line. Yeah.
And as you were trying to say something,
also. I'm not sure if it's just in the dub, but something that I really liked in the dub was that once Celeste Bluff gets called, and she gets like really angry, she just like drops the accent completely.
Oh yeah, she initially is using things like Watakshi and like very prim,
yeah,
proper language.
And she becomes an Oriko when she gets called. Like yeah, she's like, using Ore and yeah, and a very
very masculine, very rough speech.
Extremely aggressive speech.
Yeah, we were talking about this last night, Kiri, and we were kind of talking about what we were trying to figure out what the actual term for this is. We kind of
did you figure something out?
I fucking could not find it.
Great.
we had incorrectly pinned it as Kansai-ben, but it's not. It's right. Definitely Kansai not Kansai-ben. It's because she does speak very, she's very much a nor like, standard Japanese, which I guess would be,
kind of middle Kanto-ben?
Yeah, and I wouldn't say she's country, so to speak. But
I meant like the country of Japan.
Yeah, very, very, like yeah. Very, like more formal, I guess. And then she falls into more of like.
She sounds like a biker gang lady.
Yeah, she sounds kind of, and I think the framing of it's very good because I like how the trial is essentially just you slowly stripping away at everything she is and all of her pretensions of like. Honor and dignity and nobility to the point where you're taking away her fucking name.
Yeah, that's like an intense moment.
Yeah, and I like how like the way she frames it is like again like she has this air of honor and dignity, and as these accusations of treachery and murder kind of come to surface, so does, you know, her actual birth name, Yasuhiro Taiko.
Which I felt, like, side note, I definitely like the plot point. I wish it had been established at some point a little earlier. But, I mean, other than that, I still think it's an excellent reveal and an excellent use of, like, I mean, I don't know, there should have just, like, I would have preferred, like, a throwaway line where, like, one of the reasons she teams up with Hifumi is, like, oh, Hifumi figured it out or something.
I think it's implied early on.
Jed was trying to say something.
I was just going to say, one of the things that happens when you're investigating is they're just like, oh, hey, here's a monopad. There's nothing significant about this one, but we're going to put it in your truth bullets because you'll need to bring it up at, in a different context. And it would have been smarter if it was a situation where they found a monopad somewhere that had the name Yasuhiro Taiko, and they're like, huh, I don't know who this belongs to. And there was no way for them to actually check until the trial itself, and everyone was like, okay, someone here lost their monopad, and Celeste, show us your monopad, and if the monopad, if you have your monopad here, then there's nothing to worry about.
Yeah. Jackie, you're on Inez.
Inez, I'm going to pass the mic to you, because I've talked.
I definitely think that, like, the different name thing really could have been set up much better. Because the way it's presented, it kind of just feels like it does sort of just come out of nowhere. It kind of feels like the Yasuhiro thing switches from being like, oh, she's framing Yasuhiro to, oh, that's actually her name?
Yeah.
It's kind of weird. Also, why would she tell Hifumi her actual name? Mm.
Yeah, that's why I say, like, a throwaway line where, like, oh, he figured it out because he found the, like, Monokuma slipped the envelope under his door or something, because something. I mean, it's not a huge sticking point for me. Like, it's not like a huge plot hole. It's just sort of, like, it feels like it needed one or two, like, lines to kind of make it all, like, click. Other than that, I still think it's, like, an excellent, like, thematically, I find it excellent. Like you said, Jackie, like, she is being stripped of everything, including her name. Like, the name Celestia Ludenberg that she created for herself as the ultimate gambler. And how much pride she has in that name.
Like, she's very committed to her... Like, one of my favorite things about Celestia is that she's very committed to her aesthetic. Like, she's very much like the... Like, again, like, the big stupid drills that are fake, that we established are not real, that she has clipped on, and must weigh a fucking ton.
Oh, I've worn wigs lighter than that, and, like, so I cosplayed as Jack Atlas from Yu-Gi-Oh! One year, and that has a lot of hair in the wig, and that shit gets heavy. Like, over time, it just gets heavy. Her wearing that, she must have the neck strength of, like, I don't know, like a horse.
Hey folks, it's me, Kyrie. Thank you for listening to episode 6 of Ultimate Despair Reprise. Sorry for the change in audio this week. Audacity was just being a real hassle and was giving me some troubles. But hey, I hope you're enjoying the episode regardless. Anyway, time for the shoutouts. Ultimate Despair Reprise is part of the Scanline Media network of shows, and we are so honored to be hosted on there. We're on episode 6 now, and gosh, I can't thank Six and Jen enough for, you know, hosting the show and giving me the resources to make this a reality. Make sure y'all go to scanlinemedia.com for the latest in podcasts, articles, and lots of good stuff. Jennifer just wrote this great article on the new Media Molecule game, Dreams. We have just a bevy of free podcasts for your ears. We're talking the Johto Quorum. We're talking Neutral Game. Neutral Game, we just had an interview with Lost Soul. Gotta check that out. And many, many more. Also, if you go to patreon.com/scanlinemedia, you get access to the exclusive Oops All Anime. I just did an episode with Six and Jen on the new Fruits Basket, and you only gotta pay $1 a month for the whole archive. That's a steal. We're practically giving you money for all this great content. Definitely check that out. And of course, huge thank you to Vetrom for providing the music. Check them out on YouTube at youtube.com/VTMprojects for hot fire remixes of songs from Danganronpa, Pokemon, My Hero Academia, and much, much more. Give them a listen. Their music is constantly popping, and they just dropped some new Danganronpa remixes that I can't wait to use in the show. It's great stuff. Also, huge thanks to all the guests that we've had so far. Kira Buckland, Brian Beacock, and Sean Chiplock, thank you so much for coming on. Y'all are welcome anytime. Our door is always open to you. But hey, listen, let me tell you, people, this is not the end of the guests. So no, we got a special guest coming in next week. I cannot wait for you to get to hear that interview. It's going to be great. Can't wait for everyone to listen. So that's about it. That's all for me. Remember, your homework is to play Chapter 4 Daily Life of Danganronpa 1, Trigger Happy Havoc. We're almost halfway done with the first game, gang. Jeez, it's been a long... Well, I was going to say it's been a long road, and it has been, but we're just getting started. Thank you so much for listening. I can't put into words how happy it is that you're listening and that you are following along with the show. I appreciate it so much. I cannot wait for this moving forward. Anyway, catch you next time. Peace.
It's something I wanted to bring up. It's not, like, directly related to Celeste.
Sure.
Let's talk about the trial waiting games.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because that has been kind of...
They were oof McYikes.
Yeah, I was talking to my co-host about this earlier, but, like, I think that they're, like, a pretty serious accessibility concern. Like, I have a psychiatric disorder that, like, impedes my ability to multitask under pressure, and it makes the minigames, like, both really frustrating and also time-consuming to complete. Like, and moreover, like, the minigames are intrusive, too. Like, they make it hard to focus on the case. Like, I can't really think about what's happening in the case if I'm getting held up and getting frustrated at this mini game.
You can't, like, you're not able to sit there and think about, oh, what do the mechanics of this mini game mean when you're struggling with those mechanics. And I'll say, like, this is my second time going through this game, and I've played all the games in the series, and I still have trouble with those minigames, and I know, like, all their rules and intricacies, and it's like they are pretty frustrating. And that sucks.
A thing I think needs to be noted is the little pink, like, chatter that, like, your truth bullets can be lost in.
White noise.
Yeah, the white noise. My biggest issue with them is that they're not very well telegraphed, and I feel like they need to be done a lot. I feel like hopefully they're done a lot better in later games, but, like, one of the things that I felt became kind of a recurring theme was I would just fast forward through the trial the first time to see fast forward through the dialogue the first time to see when those little white noise bits would come out, because all too fucking often I would miss the target because the white noise would, like, because the target would be scrolling across the screen slowly. And then when I go to take aim at it, the white noise just shoots across, blocks the target, and then shoots across to the other side of the screen when it's gone.
Yeah,
and it's like
that mechanic.
Help. And it's not. Yeah, and it's more like, why is this here? Like, what? Like, it feels very much like somebody swatting your free shot out of the like taking a free, like a free throw in basketball, and then somebody just runs up to it and just swats it away, like when it's almost at the net. Like,
not today.
Yeah, not today. Like, you're almost, like, it feels like it's, like, especially when you figure out, like, what you're gonna do, like, it's not really a logic puzzle, it's more of, like, haha, idiot, why didn't you expect that to block your shot? And it's, like, waiting until the white noise shows up, and then hitting, right mouse button to tell it to fuck off, and then shooting isn't really satisfying enough to justify the, that it is there in the first place. It just needs work. I give it a C-, see me after class.
Yeah, like, it's the kind of thing where, like, I think of a thing that, like, well-designed puzzles tend to do, where, like, once you've figured out the solution, it shouldn't take too long to put in that solution. Yeah, and if it takes you a long time to put in your solution, even if you figured it out, then that gets really frustrating, and the white noise parts kind of feel like that, because, like, yeah, I know what I'm aiming for, it's just that the game just keeps getting in my way.
Yeah, it's one of those things where I do think the white noise segments play a bit better on the Vita, since instead of having to mouse over it, it's a situation where you're tapping on the back touchpad in the general vicinity of the white noise when it's happening. So it's much, much easier to clear it, and it's less of an issue. The other thing is, I understand there's accessibility issues here, but I do think that there is some merit to having a situation where you can't just enter the solution perfectly when you're going through these, because it's a situation where you're not facing some sort of puzzle box, you're not going on a Mist or Witness style island and entering the answer perfectly. You're in a situation where you're talking with other students who don't stop for you, they continue talking, so you have to butt in, you have to make your position known, and that's something that evolves over time within the later games, this idea of having to make your claim within a evolving discussion. But
will say, in terms of accessibility, it is definitely an issue, but I can tell you that in 2, they have, like, much stronger shading over the targetable, like, phrases. The slowdown is much more generous. And I know in V3, they actually do a thing where you can just, like, they give you a big red target on targetable phrases when you hit the slowdown button. So if you're the type of person who, like, actually wants to, like, you know, line up shots, and, you know, the game has the challenge for that, but there's also, in every statement in V3, there is, like, an alternate, like, you can hit the tail end of the statement, like, more words of the statement are lit up, and you can hit the tail end, which is typically the easier shot. And the only reward is, like, extra mono coins, and that's only there if you care about completion and getting the presents. But, yeah.
Honestly, what I think I would most like is just like a mode or a toggle or something that would let me either skip the minigames or read them in, like, the standard visual novel format.
Yeah, they do. I think when you go on the easiest difficulty setting in 2 and V3, they actually, like, you don't have to reload during panic talk actions. You don't, like they do some things to make it, like, a lot more accessible when you're just trying to play the story. But luckily, like, this game being so strong and story-focused, there's lots of, like, LP archives and videos that make it easy to kind of follow along, even,
yeah,
you're using the Something Awful one, if I recall.
Yeah, I ended up just using a Let's Play because I got too frustrated at the minigames.
Yeah, and something I will say, they get better and worse within the later games. Like, Hangman's Gambit in 2 is something of a little nightmare, because it's...
Oh my god.
instead of hitting individual letters, you kind of have to match them together and prevent other letters from smashing together and losing some of your life bar. There's
that
a bit more...
sounds like a good time.
There's some platforming. It's something. But it's, yeah.
Honestly.
Oh, man. I'm really excited for Danganronpa's 4. Danganronpa 4 is extended CRPG sequence where I have to get past... Or I have to get past the troll bridge.
Honestly,
in order to fucking say a word.
If it's not like the rhythm minigame, which I really, really don't like, then sure, yeah, I'm down for weird experimentality in these minigames. I think that's a lot more interesting than just having to do the same little rhythm minigame over and over in each case.
And it gets much better, like, in V3, like the Panic Talk actions, like they turn it into like a mini, like, do you ever play any of the Hatsune Miku rhythm games? They turn it into something like that with like really clear iconography and clear rhythm and like a lot of like, it's a really clean interface and it like plays, like there's an actual song that goes to it that you have, that you can follow the beat to. And
would it
like
happen
I said,
to be Finger Fuck Up?
No, not quite.
Okay. See, I was kind of hoping. I really wanted to see
Nagito is in
the Sands trial.
Kamigeta is in the second game, not the third game.
Well, he should be in the third game as well.
Kamigeta
is
in all of us.
Kamigeta
is a state of mind.
Kamigeta really is.
I don't know anything. I don't fucking know anything about these games except for Kamigeta. And that's enough. That was enough to sell me. Honestly.
We stand.
We do. We stand. We stand an anti-racist king.
Can I say the thing that frustrates me the most with this case?
Yeah, sure. Fuck us up.
The motive that Celeste gives Hifumi, where she essentially implies to Hifumi that she was sexually assaulted by
Yeah, that was some creep shit.
Yeah, that sucked. That sucked.
Yeah, that was honestly, I put in my notes that that was like, you know, some absolute fucking creep shit, and that this game has veered into that, like, territory a couple times before already, and we're, like, I think we're a little less than halfway through, and it's pretty fucking wild, I think.
Yeah,
it just comes out of nowhere every single time.
When the easy motive is like right there, it's like
it's literally just Taka took alter ego.
Yeah, he implicated me. He implicated me or he like fucking found a mask or something, or like she finds like a mask in a warehouse and like, oh, he wore this or something. I don't know. Like, you
or
can tell
even,
a pretty...
Or he doesn't even have to have, or she could still go with the, oh, he threatened me into doing it. But she could have just been like, oh, he threatened me to take alter ego and said if I didn't do it, he would reveal a secret. Tear off my wig.
Yeah, she it revealed like
she could have been
know,
like, oh, you know,
snatch that wig.
Yeah, he could have, like, I feel, or, like, he could have been, like, oh, you know, or she could have been, like, oh, you know, Taka threatened to take alter ego, Taka wanted me to take alter ego, he threatened that if I didn't, you know, if I didn't cooperate, she could say literally anything, I think, is the thing.
Yeah, like, that's the reason that they could have had for him finding out that she has Yasuhiro in her real name, like being like,
yeah,
okay, he threatened to reveal who I really was, and I'm really attached to who I am within this.
Yeah,
school.
She could just be like, I built my life as Celestia Ludenberg. I don't want to become Taiko again.
Yeah, and that's a much more sympathetic motive, and even like as big of a scumbag Hifumi is, I think he would still be sympathetic to that cause as an artist and be like, oh, I understand, like, you know, doujin circles in Japan very much are attached to their name because their name is their brand, you know? Like, there's a reason, like, part of the reason everybody knows Clamp is because it's a very simple, easy to remember name, and also they make some really, really good manga. But, like, he would, I think he would be sympathetic to that, you know?
Yeah.
It would be, and also it would be like, oh, if I do something nice for Celeste, maybe Celeste would do something nice for me. It's like, you don't even have to go that weird with it. It's like, I think it is one of those things where it was the translators kind of thinking like, oh, we need to make this, you know, moment more hardcore or mature or something.
Or I think it's more that they wanted to make it like kind of a, like a, sound like a hentai plot, because that's what, that's the sort of shit that, you know, our little fuck machine, Hifumi would fall for.
Yeah, which, like, fair enough.
God, he's so fucking horny, I hate it.
Yeah, like, they really don't have to go into detail about what she said, I think. Like, that's not an important detail, and all it does really is just make the scene really uncomfortable.
Yeah.
It's probably, that is, like, really my biggest problem with this case in general. Jen, did you have anything else to say about the case?
I was just going to briefly... I figured we should probably talk about the execution and the brief scene after the trial.
Yeah, I was just about to mention.
Inez, tell us about the execution.
Okay, so... Celeste, at the end, like... kind of accepts her fate. Like, the last thing she says is, take care, everyone. Perhaps we'll meet again in another life. And then the execution begins.
Oh, I also thought that a very good line from that was that weak smile was her final lie. Like, it somehow, like, before that she goes, she talks about how she wanted to, you know, again, I think we touched on it, that she was like, oh, I wanted to live in a European castle with 1,000 vampire butlers. Who were also
We touched on that, which is like my and Jen's fantasy at this point, because like living in a castle with
it made me furiously jot down some notes for the next time I run Curse of Strahd. But you know, I think that was a really funny moment. Like, her doing murder for aesthetic is legitimately hilarious.
Yeah.
And I very much thought that they were gonna know that I had to claw my way up from nothing through illegal gambling, and I still had so much further to go or some shit. And I feel like that was still kind of implied when it was like, oh yeah, her weak smile was her final lie. Because I think like low key she was lying about that entire motive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She is a gambler. Like, maintaining a poker face is part of the skill.
Or even more that, you know, she has already lost her life and everything else. That she doesn't want to also lose, like, everybody else's lives.
Yeah.
In a sense, like, if she was to go, like, if she was to make it, like, really tragic, like, oh, I just wanted to get out of here, you know, I crawled my way up from nothing, and to be put down like this is the ultimate insult, like, that would hurt for everybody who kind of sympathized with her.
Yeah.
So she's kind of pulling back to soften the blow.
Yeah.
Making up this ludicrous story about 1,000 vampire butlers.
Yes, which I think Madokuma kind of calls with the burning of the Versailles
Retrocution. There's also like a line a little earlier where Celeste mentions that she doesn't really care how she gets killed, but she mentions that if she were to be reincarnated, then she would like to come back as Marie Antoinette. And Yasuhiro mentions that she'd just get executed again, and Celeste just kind of nods and agrees with him.
Yeah, Celeste is probably, like, in this game, definitely, like, there's a lot of depth to her character. She's one of the best realized characters, I think, in this game, and like I adore Celeste so much, and I think this case did a really good job in, like, it's kind of like the execution is kind of a microcosm of, like, what's good about her character or what's good about this like case is that we have this like very kind of somber, serious like moment where she is, you know, put on a pole and set, you know, a little Monokuma starts a fire and she's about to be burned like a witch. And then a big fucking red fire truck careens into the scene, hits a ramp, and just completely annihilates her, like, in one fell swoop, which is at first, like, kind of hilarious, but then you realize it's also kind of tragic, because it is really the most insulting thing you could do to her, in a way.
Yeah, thematically, I do agree with that, but also, I think that getting brained by a gigantic fire truck would hurt a little less than burning to death, but
sure,
that's just me.
I mean, yeah, yes. I guess that is true, but also, like, I feel like it's less about hurting her physically and more about, like, hurting her dignity. Like, she's entirely, like, I feel like she, like, oh yeah, it sucks to burn to death, but you're dying, but you are dying either way, and you will suffocate, and, like, you'll suffocate at the stake before it actually lights you aflame.
Yeah, I think that's kind of part of Celeste's last resolve, is that she's going to go to her death on her own terms with the smile, and then the fire truck just completely ruins all that.
And then
Monokuma
takes that away. Yeah.
Like, Fitty jumps over that big-ass ramp and just ruins her big moment.
Yeah, like, that's the entire point of that sequence is that, like, is Monokuma essentially saying, you know, I know how to hurt you the most, and it's not, you know, lighting you aflame, it's denying you the ability to go out without looking like a clown asshole. Like, you spent so long trying to build up your dignity, and now you're gonna die without fame. Yeah, like, I feel like the only execution that would be more insulting to Celeste, and if this wasn't a series about, like, you know, hope and despair, I feel like Monokuma would just pull a Glock out and cap her.
Monokuma's got a gun. Yeah, sorry. I apologize for that one.
Oh,
well,
yeah,
I'm sure
that
at some point someone's gonna get executed by gun by Monokuma.
It's, yeah, but it's, like, this chapter, it's something I want to mention, like you said, with, like, her facade. I have access to the post-game, and I realized I had, like, one more, like, social link level with Celeste, so I actually went back and completed her social link, and what happens is she talks about Makoto saying, congratulations, you are now a B-grade. In my eyes, and he's talking about, like, well, B, what are you talking about? She said, well, I see most of the world as a bunch of C's or a bunch of D's, but you are the only one of the few people that I consider a B. There's only a handful of people in this world like that. And she was asking him basically for, like, fealty and loyalty. And it definitely felt like, to me, that was part of Celeste's facade of, like, nobility and distance, but she's had to, like, do that for so long, she's forgotten how to be, like, genuine with someone, except on some of the most absurd terms, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah. I love Celeste. She's
Celeste fucking rules.
Yeah, this was a fucking great send-off.
Aside from some problematic elements and, like, the frustrating minigames, it's like, I think I agree with you. So far, this is, like, my favorite chapter in the game.
Yeah.
Like, it's been pretty consistently excellent, and, like, I'm glad you really enjoyed it, because it's a really enjoyable case. But something happens after the case. Jennifer, tell us what happens after the case.
Well, first, after they receive the key from Celeste and do a few maneuvers, Monokuma knows something is up at this point, but he's not in a position to press too hard about it, so
Well, he tries to, and then Kirigiri says something to, like, kind of push back against him, if you recall.
Oh, yeah. She basically goes, I'll tell you what's up if you tell me what's up with this specific thing. And, I forget exactly what it was.
Like, she basically said, like, I'll tell you what this key means if you tell me something important, right? And at first he takes the deal, and then she says, what did you do to my body? What did you do to my memories? And Monokuma is like, he does not answer. Like, for the first time...
like, I don't know! And he just always out. It's great.
Yeah. For the first time in this entire game, they finally have, like, Monokuma on the back foot. Like, for moment.
Well, Kirigiri specifically has Monokuma on the back foot. I feel like... Oh, shit, I forgot to say this, but, there's a point in the trial where Celeste and Kyoko are, like, staring each other down and just going, having a back and forth. And it was some absolute Kill Bill shit. Like, they were extremely, like, it was hype. They were just really going to town on him. And, fuck, that was, and, like, I think, in my notes, I was like, this fucking rules, this is a good-ass trial for this alone. So, that's my review of this trial, 10 out of 10. I want to see Kirigiri and Celestia just fucking duel. Just fucking showdown. I could watch a whole game about that. I could play a whole game about that. Literally just that.
So once they get into the bathhouse after additionally throwing Monokuma off their trail, it's Kyoko and Makoto. And they confirm that, yeah, Celeste didn't hurt Alter Ego at all. She was just sitting there in the locker, hidden away from everyone else. And Makoto uses that opportunity to talk with... basically be like, okay, I'd really appreciate it if you told me what was going... why you continuously disappear and brought me into what we're doing. And it's kind of this trust relationship that gets set up. So she tells him, okay, there's a specific bathroom at a specific floor where if you go, there's no cameras within this bathroom, and there's something behind the janitorial closet section, essentially. So he goes in there, he pushes against the wall, and finds a gigantic number of Hope's Peak...
like personnel files,
basically. Yeah, personnel files, documents... and something slips out from one of them that basically says, you must not leave. He recalls having seen that. And at that point, someone sneaks up from behind him and basically... he
clobbers him with a pipe.
Yeah, and then everything is gone.
Well, we know who it is. It's
yeah, do we?
Yeah, totally. It's Master Smith from Killer 7.
I was thinking Mask the Mask from the Ace Attorney franchise. But yeah, it's one of those dramatic irony things where it's, you know, Makoto can't see it because he's too wrapped up in looking at these documents. But we, the audience, can see the masked figure, like, clobber him with the, pipe. And then, like I said, on Wake Up, you know, he tried to punish on Wake Up, but they were just gone. And just the only document I think was left was that document that says you must not leave. Or something to that effect.
Yeah.
So it's powerful stuff.
And while he's in that state, barely able to process the area around him, he hears fighting on the first floor. He wanders, he peeks into the gym and still has head throbbing, so it looks like a dream somewhat. He sees Sakura and Monokuma fighting, and Monokuma specifically saying, are you betraying me right now? So.
Yeah, what do y'all think about that particular scene? Yeah, like Monokuma and Sakura are doing the classic, like, Kamen Rider thing where they're flying by each other and doing a kicking pose. Like, it's very over the top, and you get this pan up where they are just radiating heat from each other from just how intensely they are fighting. But yeah, but like, that's kind of the big reveal, is that like, Sakura is a spy for Monokuma.
Honestly, I'm just really glad that, like, Sakura finally got a moment to just be cool.
Yeah. It's so cool. So this is what...
Sakura getting a chance to be cool is, like... That's most of what I wanted from her character.
Yeah, this is why I want a Danganronpa fighting game. Because I main Sakura. Yeah. So, do we have any other thoughts on Chapter 3 before we wrap up?
Actually, there was a scene where, towards the end, where post-trial, where Kyoko and Makoto had got like a little bit together in the, the bathhouse area. And my notes went like this. Oh, I really wish Kyoko and Makoto had some chemistry if the game was going to do the shipping stuff with them. As it stands, Kyoko's just a mysterious girl, and Makoto's her gopher. I didn't even fucking finish that sentence. Because I was like, ah, shit, dog. Okay, this is the scene I was asking for. Right there. They actually set up, like, a pretty good dynamic. I wish this scene happened earlier. I guess that's my only gripe with Danganronpa, is I feel like it could have gone a little quicker. And, because, like, I think that's the thing, is, like, it sets all these character archetypes up. And it's all good stuff. But you could definitely take these archetypes and just speed it up by, like, a chapter or a half a chapter.
This is why I'm so excited for Danganronpa 2, because Danganronpa 2, like, I think when they made the second game, they realized the thing that people really loved about these games wasn't necessarily, like, solving the murders is fun and all, but, like, the real fun kind of is from seeing all these characters interact with each other and bounce off each other and grow. And I think, like, I vividly recall Danganronpa 2, 3, and B3 being really just chock full of really great character moments, like the one between Makoto and Kirigiri. And, like I said, I'm really excited for that. But this was kind of a sweet moment, but it was also a moment of, like, vulnerability for Kirigiri, which we didn't get.
It fucking rocks that, like, that Kirigiri just gets a moment to not be tough and cool all the time. And she just gets a moment to be, like, you know, gets a moment where we can see how she ticks a little bit more. I mean, she's still tough and cool, but, like, you know. Yeah.
Even just for the next chapter we have ahead, I think it's the strongest one in the game, so I'm looking forward to see how other folks think about it.
I vividly remember, like, many moments from Chapter 4, and Chapter 4 is an absolute treat.
Yeah.
But I think that's it, unless we had anything else.
I think I've said everything I wanted to.
And I've said more than enough.
Well, we did it. We're moving on to Chapter 4 next time. So your homework for next time is to do the daily life section of Chapter 4 of Danganronpa 1 Trigger Happy Havoc. This is a great case, and I'm really looking forward to this next episode and this next set of chapters that we're going to be going through. Anyway, I've been Kyrie.
And I'm Jennifer.
I've been Jackie.
I'm Inez.
Class dismissed, everybody. Is Morgan a fuck god?
Is who?
Morgan. You know, from the Vampire Savior franchise.
I have no clue what we're talking about.
Big titty vampire.
You mean from Darkstalkers?
What, Jen? You gave me a look. Jennifer, explain your look. I said big titty vampire.
I was gonna say...
There are a fucking ton of big titty vampires. Which one are you talking about?
Yeah, I was gonna say, who calls so it immortal vampire
mean,
or whatever, not Darkstalkers?
Do you mean Morrigan from Darkstalkers? Or do you mean a different Morrigan? Because there are quite a few vampires named Morrigan.
That is true.
I'm so used to saying Inez, I swear to God. Kiri, I swear innocent. To God.
Don't frame me for this bullshit.
Inez is innocent this time and this time only.
I'm always innocent.
Fucking, I'm hollering emotionally. I am emotionally devastated. This is some bull fucking shit.